Well, I wonder today how you might answer the question, what is the greatest problem in your life right now? You know, I think if you were to ask the average person on the street, they likely would probably describe some stressful situation or difficult circumstance that they are walking through. If you asked a professing Christian, they might try to get theological on you and say something like, well, sin, you know, isn't sin always our greatest problem? But this morning, brothers and sisters, I want us to consider another possibility. That perhaps many of our troubles actually come from an ignorance of God. That our problems would actually be far less problematic to us if it were not for an ignorance of God. It was J.I. Packer who argued in his book, Knowing God, that an ignorance of God is what lies at the root of much of the church's weakness today, and that even Christians have a concerning tendency to think of God or to view God as though they were looking through the wrong end of a telescope, or to so reduce him in size, to shrink him down to such tiny proportions that the reason our problems seem so big to us is because God is so small to us. In fact, I actually remember being in my early 20s and reading Knowing God for the first time at a pretty significant time in my young Christian life. And I remember the impact that it made on me when Packer talked about how cruel it would be to take a tribesman from the Amazon, to yank him out of the jungle, to put him on a plane, to fly him to London, to set him down in the middle of the city without any explanation or any understanding of England or English, and then leave him there to fend for himself. And that likewise, quote, we are cruel to ourselves if we try to live in this world without knowing the God whose world it is. That the world becomes a mad, strange, painful place, and life in it a disappointing and unpleasant business for those who do not know God. You sentence yourself to stumble and blunder through life, blindfolded, as it were, with no sense of direction and no understanding of what surrounds you. See, get God wrong, and it's hard to get anything else right. And therefore, the great remedy, right, not only for our problems, but really for all of life, is a greater awareness of God. Right, but not just a God of our own creation, right, or a God of our own imaginations, but to know God as he really is. Right, to know God as he has revealed himself to be. Right, in his word, his ways, his nature, his character, his attributes, his purposes, his promises. And as we re-engage with the story of Exodus this morning, I believe that we'll see that this is exactly what Moses needed. It's what we all need. And as we cover chapters 3 and 4 this morning, these two chapters are interesting because they involve sort of a repeating series of revelations and questions. Right, questions and revelations, right back and forth, where God reveals more and more of himself to Moses, right? His name, his identity, his character, his plans, and Moses then responds with a series of questions or even objections, and back and forth we go between God and Moses. We begin with a revelation. The revelation. We saw last week how the people of Israel had multiplied, but had become enslaved, chapter 1. And that although Moses' life had been preserved, by the middle of chapter 2, we find him running for his life. But none of this was a surprise to God. And in fact, every detail had unfolded according to the plan and the purposes of God. And chapter 3 now opens with what is now an 80-year-old Moses, according to Acts chapter 7. And it gives us a little window into what Moses has been doing for the past 40 years of his life. Verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, every detail here is significant, right? Reminding us of how Moses has been humbled, right? From the palace to the pasture, right? From mingling with Egyptian royalty to now tending sheep. Right, the reminder of who his father-in-law is reminding us of how Moses has most likely married into a devout, practicing, pagan, Baal-worshipping family. Right, the wilderness there called Horeb literally can be translated a waste or a wasteland. Right, all of these little details sort of add up to paint a picture of a man who seems lost and wandering and seemingly as far away from God as humanly possible. And yet, in the sovereign plan and purposes of God, all of these things have combined to actually put Moses right in the path of God. For God has not only preserved Moses' life, right, but as we talked about last week, God has been at work, right, molding and shaping and refining Moses' life so that at just the right time, when Moses wasn't looking for God at all, God comes looking for Moses. And the wasteland of Horeb indeed becomes the mountain of God, when God suddenly and dramatically reveals himself to Moses. Verse 2, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I'll turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. Now, the ESV says great sight. Other translations say strange sight. Other translations say remarkable sight. I think every adjective is probably appropriate here. Because Moses sees a bush on fire, except the bush itself isn't burning. That somehow the fire is actually distinct from the bush, right? As if somehow it is not dependent upon the bush to actually burn. It's somehow burning independently of the bush, as if it doesn't need the bush to burn. But this non-burning burning bush is not the strangest thing about it. Even stranger is that it knows his name. And a voice calls out from the bush, Moses, Moses. Or it's a voice that is first identified in verse 2 as the angel of the Lord, but then in verse 4, it is identified as belonging to the Lord himself, that God called out to him from the bush. And as one scholar explains, angels in general can represent one aspect or another of the divine nature, but in the angel of the Lord, he is fully present, that when this angel comes, the Lord himself comes. So this non-burning, burning bush is none other than a revelation of God himself. In fact, fire is frequently a sign of God's presence in the book of Exodus. And that actually helps explain why the bush was on fire, but it wasn't burning, right? It was a self-burning, self-sustaining, self-sufficient fire, because somehow in the midst of the fire, present in the fire, was the self-sustaining, self-sufficient one himself. Distinct and independent from his creation. He didn't need the bush in order to burn. He is his own source of being, life, and energy. But when God appears to Moses in the fire, well, like any fire, fire has a way of drawing you in, doesn't it? Anybody who's ever sat around a campfire sort of knows how it's amazing, its ability to sort of hold your attention and sort of suck you in. You can just sort of sit there for hours watching it. But it also has a way of warning us, right? That if we get too close, it's dangerous. So you'd better keep an appropriate distance from fire. And thus God speaks from the fire and he warns Moses, tells Moses not to come any closer because the place where he's standing is holy ground. That one is not free to tread lightly in the presence of God. Right, as Moses would soon learn, though he is good, he is not safe. That he is not to be trifled with. He is not your pal. He is not your peer. He's not your mate. He's not your equal. That God is, in fact, awful and terrible in the old meaning of the words, as one writer puts it. That he evokes awe. He strikes terror. And once Moses realizes that he's actually dealing with God, and not just the false God of his father-in-law, but the one true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, verse 6, he hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. End of verse 6. Right, just instinctively doing what even the heavenly creatures do in the presence of a holy, awesome, glorious, indescribable God. Isaiah 6, verse 2. Right, for he is high and lifted up. Isaiah 6, verse 1. Right, enthroned in unapproachable light. 1 Timothy 6, verse 16. He is, in fact, a consuming fire. Hebrews 12, verse 29. But that's not all God is. And as he continues to speak, he reveals more of himself to Moses. And we learn, as one writer puts it, that he is not only a God above us, high and lifted up, but he is also a God among us, close and near. And though he is far more holy and awesome and glorious than we could ever imagine, he is also far more condescending and gracious and merciful than we could ever imagine. He tells Moses that he's seen the affliction of his people, that he knows their sufferings, and he's heard their cries, right? You notice, right? Pay attention to the repetition of words here from what we saw at the end of chapter 2, right? That he is indeed a God who hears and sees and knows each one of us. But then pay attention as well to this particular word play, because it's the crucial word play here. Right, chapter 2, verse 23, we read their cry for rescue came up to God. And so now, chapter 3, verse 8, I have come down to deliver them. Yes, he is high and lifted up, and yet he's the God who comes down. Right, a consuming fire who also condescends. Right, transcendent and yet personal. The God who is, in fact, close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. Psalm 34, verse 18. Right? In fact, he is the one who will one day be called Emmanuel. The God who comes down to be with us, to save us. Matthew 1, verse 23. So he is a God who comes down, and he's a God who comes down because he is a God who has remembered his covenant. chapter 2, verse 24. In fact, never forgetting it. It's not that God had forgotten, but people sometimes forget. And so he tells Moses in verses 8 and 9 that he will, in fact, be faithful to his covenant promises, that what he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he will, in fact, do, that he will deliver them from their bondage and bring them home to a land of promise. But there's a catch, and it involves Moses personally. God gives it to him in verse 10. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. See, it's all good when God says, yeah, I see, I hear, I care, I understand, I'll act, I'll deliver. Sounds great, sounds good, I like that plan. But when God says, oh yeah, and by the way, that plan involves sending you to be the means through which I work and do what I say. Well, that's when Moses starts to have questions. All right, which brings us to a set of questions. Beginning in verse 11 with, who am I? you want me to do? Are you serious? You want me to go to Egypt, to Pharaoh? Are you serious? Who am I? And this, brothers and sisters, this is where we start to learn something very, very important. And that is every revelation from God is actually a call for a response to God. Right, God reveals something to Moses about who he is and what he's going to do and what he's promised, not simply for information's sake, right? Not simply to just sort of alleviate Moses's ignorance as if to say, okay, buddy, now you know, right? Great, have a nice day. When God tells us who he is, when he speaks from his word and he reveals to us his character and his nature and his plans and his promises, attached to every revelation he has given us is a call to respond in trust and obedience. God tells us who he is as a call to trust him and obey him in light of who he is. In response to who he is. He's not simply giving you information. Oh, great, now you know. No, he's calling you to respond. Which is why I love God's answer in verse 12, which is sort of a non-answer. Right? When Moses asks, who am I? Right? God essentially says, who cares? Right? Moses, listen, I love you. I really do. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who you are. What matters is who I am. And quote, I will be with you, verse 12. In other words, Moses, if you really knew, you really understood who it is that is with you, you'd be all right. You'd be okay. You wouldn't be so worried about who you are because you would know that if I'm with you, it's enough. It's more than enough. In fact, Moses, let me assure you that simply because I will be with you, know this. Write it down, remember it. Don't forget it. When you bring the people out of Egypt, you will serve me on this very mountain. End of verse 12. Right? Now, we have to wait until chapter 19, but sure enough, the wasteland of Mount Horeb becomes Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. just like God said. But brothers and sisters, pay attention to the fact that God doesn't really answer Moses' question. Right? Not directly, anyway. He doesn't say, okay, Moses, let's talk about who you are. Let's sort of go over your skill set and what I like about you. No, what does he do? He shifts Moses' focus away from who Moses is. Because it's not about you, Moses. Shifts Moses' focus away from who Moses is to who God is. And he effectively says to Moses, Moses, listen, find your sense of identity, find your confidence, find your peace, find your assurance, not mainly in yourself, but in me. In who I am. Which actually then provokes Moses to just ask another question. And it's a good question, right? Which is essentially, okay, well then, who are you then? Tell me more about who you are. Because let's say, okay, Lord, let's say, verse 13, let's say that I go to the people and I tell them, hey guys, the God of your fathers, he's sent me to you. And let's say they ask, well, what's his name? You know, after all, they are living in a culture where there's about 40 dozen different gods and they all go by a different name. So, you know, what do I tell them? Well, that leads to another revelation from the Lord, right? God graciously says to Moses, Moses, I would love to tell you more about who I am. So when Moses asks, the Lord is more than happy to oblige. And he answers in verse 14, I am who I am. Say to the people, I am has sent me to you. Now, at first, that might sound like an insanely weird or cryptic answer. But it's actually a theologically loaded answer. Right? One that one commentator says is deliberately designed to burst our definitions of what it means to be. Right? One that is meant to communicate to us, listen, God is not defined or controlled or limited or restricted by anything outside of himself. Right? He exists independent of his creation, right? It is a statement of unhindered, self-sustaining, self-sufficient, self-determined self-existence. Okay, unending and never changing. The same yesterday, today, and forever, right? I am who I am means I have always been who I have always been, and I will always be who I will always be. Unconstrained, unlimited, unchallenged, unhindered by anything else. Now, friends, you and I don't exist like that. At all, right? Who I am does not exist independently from everything else, right? I need air to breathe and food to eat all the time to keep being, right? To live, to exist, right? Who I am is highly influenced by the things around me. I'm affected by time, right, molded by people and parents and culture and upbringing, right? Even more than that, who I am is also profoundly limited and constrained and restricted, right? No matter how much I would like to be a world champion, professional, Olympic athlete of any kind, pick a sport, I'll take water polo or figure skating for that matter. It doesn't matter. I'd like to hop off the stage and fly around the room, but my lack of ability, my lack of talent severely limits who I can be. I'd like to be a perfect husband and a perfect father for that matter. That's not happening either. God is not like this. As Tim Chester writes, God's identity is unconstrained. He will be who he decides to be. He will do what he decides to do. God is radically free. Free to be and do whatever he chooses. Nothing and no one can force him to be or do anything against his will. And thus, the only thing he is ever bound by is simply the perfection of his holy nature. The perfection of his own character. But since it is perfect, it lacks nothing that is good or right or true or desirable. In fact, it is the perfect standard of everything that is good and right and true and beautiful and desirable. And thus, he is who he is perfectly. Nothing lacking. And brothers and sisters, that is our great hope. Because it means that he is perfectly, eternally, unchangeably dependable and reliable and trustworthy. As Tim Chester then goes on to write, he's not just I was, and further, he is not I may be. He is, I am, and I will be. I put ifs on many of my commitments because I can't be sure that I can deliver. I'll help if I can, I say. I'll come if I'm free. I'll do it if there's time. But you can be sure God will deliver all that he has promised because I will be what I will be. And brothers and sisters, what he has been and what he is now and what he will always be is a promise-keeping God. Right? And so when he says to Moses in verse 17, hey, Moses, I promise that I will deliver you from your bondage and bring you and my people into the land of promise, it will be because he is who he is. And if Moses needed any further assurance, God gives him not only a theological name, but I am who I am that I am. He gives him a personal name, right? The Lord. Verse 15, it's in all caps, that's on purpose, because it's Yahweh or Jehovah. Right? It's God's covenant name. Right? It's the name by which he had personally loved and called a people to himself for himself. Right? It was the name, therefore, by which that people would then know him forever, right? From generation to generation, end of verse 15. So it's the name by which he had personally bound himself to a people and had committed to save that people for his glory. Bound to it. And so he can say to Moses, no, Moses, go, gather the elders of Israel, tell them who I am, tell them what I said, tell them what I'm going to do, verses 16 and 17. They will listen to you, verse 18. Pharaoh won't, verse 19. It's okay. I've got a plan and I've got a purpose in that. And when my plan and purpose is complete, then he will let you go, verse 20. And when he lets you go, also, by the way, he's not going to let you go empty-handed. I'm going to make sure you walk out of there with a few other things as well. Verse 21 and verse 22, some silver and some gold and some cloth and some stuff. Now, Moses doesn't know that, but that will ultimately be for the tabernacle. But the point here is to say to Moses, hey, Moses, do you get it? Do you understand what it means that I am? That I am, that I am the Lord. It means that God is not a man that he should lie. Right? Numbers 23, verse 19. That if he has sworn it, he shall surely do it. Isaiah 14, verse 24, for he is the one who works all things according to the counsel of his own will. Ephesians 1, verse 11. So if he says something, then you should know that his word is as reliable as his character. So if God says, hey, that's how it's going to go down, then that's how it's going to go down. And you might think, okay, that maybe that's enough for Moses. Actually triggers another question. More of an objection, really, chapter 4, verse 1. Then Moses answered, but behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. Now, even though that's a statement, I mean, you could rephrase that as a question, right? It's as if Moses is asking, all right, Lord, listen, even if I believe you, what if they don't? Right? What if they say, nah, Moses, you crazy. He did not, what? Right? What then, Lord? Right? What if that happens? What if? Now, isn't that typical of us? How we worry about the future, about what's going to happen, and we think to ourselves, okay, well, what about this? What about that? Well, what if this happens? What if that happens, right? As if maybe we've thought of something that God hasn't thought of, or maybe there's some scenario that might play out in a way. Maybe the Lord hasn't totally factored that into all of the equation, as if maybe the outcome isn't really in God's hands, at least maybe not the way that I want it to be. So God very graciously says to Moses, oh, okay, Moses, let me show you that my word is good. Right? That you really can trust me and that you really should obey me. And the Lord then gives Moses not so much of a revelation, but more of a demonstration in verses 2-9. Hey, Moses, see that staff in your hand? Uh-huh. Throw it on the ground. Moses throws it on the ground, turns into a snake. Moses screams. He runs away from it. God says, now, Moses, grab it by the tail. Moses grabs it by the tail. It's a staff again. All right, good. Now do this. Take your hand, slip it into your cloak. Okay, now take it back out. Takes it back out. Moses' hand's covered in leprosy, completely diseased. Moses, take your hand, stick it back in your cloak, okay? Sticks it back in his cloak. Now, Moses, take your hand back out of your cloak. Moses pulls his hand back out of his cloak. Now, see that? Perfectly restored, healthy, whole, once again. Okay, now, Moses, do you get it? Do you see what happens when you do what I say? Right? When you trust me and obey me, that when you do what I say, you will discover that I do what I say. That I'm faithful. I'm true. My word is trustworthy. It is a solid rock for your life. I always do what I say. So when you do what I say, you can trust I'll do what I say. Now, once again, you think that might be enough. Moses once again reverts back to thinking about himself. Verse 10, it's like, okay, yeah, Lord, okay, yeah. Your word might be great. Your word might be dependable, but me, my words, oh, Lord, you don't know. I'm not that eloquent. I'm slow of speech. I don't really talk that good. You know, if you want me to go and give a speech to Pharaoh and to the people, I don't really know if I can do it, right? So we've got a little bit of a pattern here, don't we? Focus on self, fear of the future. Focus on self, fear of the future. Focus on self, fear. Back and forth we go. Isn't that typical? And God's response is, Moses, you got your eyes fixed on all the wrong things, son. Fix your eyes on me. On me. I give speech. I give words, I give hearing, I give sight, verse 11. I do these things. So you may be keenly aware of your own insufficiencies, but God. Look up, Moses. I mean, it's like God says to Moses, and to all of us really for that matter, listen, I know exactly who you are. I knit you together in your mother's womb. Psalm 139. But my way is often to use the foolish things of this world to shame the wise things of this world, and to use the weak things of this world to shame the strong of this world. 1 Corinthians 1 verse 27. So whatever you think you lack, trust me, I am more than capable of making up the difference. Now, surely then at this point, Moses is going to say something really spiritual. Right? Like super faith-filled, like, oh man, that just put me over the edge. Something like, oh yes, those who know your name put their trust in you. For you, O Lord, have never forsaken those who seek you. Psalm 9, verse 10. Or maybe something like, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. Proverbs 18, verse 10. All right, let's go. Let's do it. Let's march on down to Egypt. Instead, verse 13, God, could you just send somebody else? Anybody. I don't want to go. I don't want to do it. And brothers and sisters, this is where we learn something else really, really, really important. That while it is certainly true, our trust in God only grows when our understanding of who God is grows. That is true. You cannot trust what you don't know. Right? So God graciously overcomes what we don't know, and he gives us his word, and he reveals his name and his character and his attributes and his ways and his promises so that we're not ignorant. However, what Moses does here is teach us that there's still a choice, right? That we still have to take what we know and what God has actually revealed to us and choose to trust it. To take what we know and what God has said to us and choose to obey it. There's still a choice. Right, Jerry Bridges writes, trust is not a passive state of mind. It is a vigorous act of the soul. It's this choice, this thing that happens inside of us that we intentionally do. He says, trust in God is first of all a matter of knowledge. We must know that God is sovereign and wise and loving. But having been exposed to the knowledge of the truth, we must then choose whether to believe the truth about God, which he has revealed to us, or whether to follow our feelings, or our fears, or attach whatever else you want to at the end of that sentence, whatever else it may be, right? Moses could not claim ignorance at this point. At this point, Moses has a choice. Would he fear the future or put his faith in the one who held the future? Right? Would he keep focusing on himself and all of his insufficiency, or on the Lord and all of his all sufficiency? Right? Upon which of those things would Moses choose to fix his thoughts? And his eyes and his mind and his heart and his meditations and his consideration as he pondered these things. But one choice would drive him toward trust and obedience. The other choice would drive him toward unbelief and disobedience. And we know what Moses chose, at least in this moment, which is why verse 14 says the Lord was angry. Right? It displeased him, right? It grieved him that Moses would still somehow find him untrustworthy, unreliable, undependable, as if somehow the Lord might actually let him down, or somehow maybe the Lord didn't really have his best interest at heart. Or maybe Moses just thought, oh, it's too much. It's too hard. I don't know exactly what Moses was thinking, but there was something. There was something, right, that Moses thought that was on the other side of trust and obedience that he wasn't sure he'd actually like. Maybe something hard, maybe something painful, maybe something he just didn't really want to deal with. But whatever it was, whatever he thought was on the other side of trust and obedience, he doubted that it would actually be good. And maybe you're here this morning and you can relate. There's doubt that on the side, the other side of trust and obedience, is there really something good? But it's amazing how patient, even accommodating, the Lord is here. After all, he knows our frame. He knows we are but dust. Psalm 103. That's why he even says to have mercy on those who doubt. Jude verse 22. Right, Moses was not the first to doubt. I mean, Sarah laughed at God's promise. I don't know about that, Lord. And Moses wasn't the first to doubt. Moses wouldn't be the last to doubt. Or even John the Baptist had his moments. Could you go ask the Lord if he's really the Messiah? All right, so did Peter. Peter doubted. Steps out of the boat, begins to sink. Jesus says to him, why did you doubt? Thomas doubted. They all doubted. And God had mercy on them all. So God has mercy on Moses in this moment. And he says to him, listen, I'm still sending you. You're still going to have to trust me and you're still going to have to obey me. But you won't have to do it alone. I'll send you a helper, your brother, Aaron. And Moses yields, Moses surrenders. But as chapter 4 then moves toward a close, it's actually punctuated or accented just by these statements of the Lord's faithfulness. Right? He said that he would teach Moses what to do and what to say. Moses, I'll teach you. I'll be with you in your mouth. I'll teach you, verse 12. And he does. Verses 19 through 23, he tells him more about what to do, tells him more about what to say. Right? He said that he would send Aaron, and he does, verse 27. And he said that the elders of Israel would listen and that they would believe, and wouldn't you know it, they do. Verse 31. Just as God said, God is faithful because he is that he is perfectly and forever. Band can come. Brothers and sisters, I don't know where you might be troubled today, where you're doubting. Maybe worried about the future. I mean, perhaps you're like Moses, sort of preoccupied with yourself this morning, your shortcomings, your inadequacies, your just eyes on self. And maybe like Moses, maybe you've been asking God your own set of questions. And maybe you're not getting the direct answers or the explanations that you're wanting. And maybe that's because God knows that he literally could answer all of your questions and you would still lack peace and be anxious and fear the future and be troubled. And that's because what you really need, what we all really need, is to take our eyes off of everything else and fix them squarely on who he is. Right, to occupy our hearts and our minds and our thoughts with less of everything else and more of him. So what are the situations right now where you are finding it hard to make that choice to trust him? Hard to make that choice to obey him? Whatever they are, whatever the situations are, he is graciously, patiently, inviting you to come to him, to walk with him, to sit with him, to grow with him in his word, to know him more and more deeply. Calling you to trust him and obey him, that he might prove himself faithful even to you. So Father, I pray that your voice would be heard through your word this morning. Father, the realities and truths of who you are, Lord, would explode in our hearts with a depth of understanding and a certainty of their realities in a way, Lord, that we trust you and will obey you. We ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Stand and sing one more time together.